The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. We're here to talk about the issues that can make a difference in our lives. In that context, we explore the larger principles of wellness. Within the concept of wellness, we'll talk about the wellness of our environment, the wellness of our behavior, of our institutions, of our inner communication skills, how we communicate and how we shouldn't, what we eat, what we drink, what we breathe. So we look at the world from a very broad perspective. For example, tomorrow we'll be having a very special Earth Day, Conversations with Remarkable Minds, Dr. Vandana Shiva, who will be filming for our newest documentary, will be in studio. We'll be talking with her about her views of being the leading environmental advocate in India, but also known throughout the world. And she is just one of many individuals we're going to have on to talk about what's happening with our soil, our climate, our nuclear programs. Because we look at it not just what's happening in the United States, but what's happening everywhere. Later today in this program, we'll be speaking with Dr. Lynn Saputo. He is a board-certified physician. He is also graduated from Duke University Medical School. He has been a professor. So he's going to take on Big Pharma and the medical paradigm and flawed medical ethics that we discuss repeatedly on this program. The newest information on genetic engineering being banned. Which countries have chosen to ban all genetically engineered food? There are three of them. Do you know which three? Well, America's not one of them. I'll give you that as well. And our issues of the day will focus upon the work of Tom Engelhardt, and he will be talking about sleepwalking into the imperial dark. And this is from tomdispatch.com. Also, I realized yesterday many people were not able to get on. We'll try to get you on today. Let's begin. Always looking at the peer-reviewed literature to show us what good science is talking about when it concerns health. Vitamin K2. There's growing evidence that vitamin K2 is not just good for our bones, but also good for our cardiovascular health. It's becoming one of the most important nutrients we can consume. Most people don't get vitamin K2, but if you did, you could have a lot of healthier bones. I'm suggesting that you take vitamin K2. You don't have to take much, 2, 3, 4 milligrams a day, and always take it with vitamin D, calcium and magnesium, manganese, and boron. You take those all together, and you're going to have a much, much lower risk of having osteoporosis and much healthier heart. I'm always interested in anti-aging. I've spent my entire adult life as a scientist, as research fellow at the Institute of Biology and Anti-Aging Medicine, but also as a clinician, as a board-certified clinician. Every day I counsel people with a myriad of conditions. And the very first thing I ask a person is, what do you want to achieve? Now, it's interesting what they say, and how they say and what they say frequently determines whether or not you're going to be able to help that person. For example, I ask, how healthy do you want to be? And without exception, they don't want to be too healthy. How happy? Well, not excessively happy. And I'm saying, why not? Why wouldn't you want to be as healthy and happy as possible? That shows you how much conditioning there has been in their lives to allow them to believe that there's a limit to how healthy or happy they could be, should be, or even deserve to be. And then I get this from the older people, older meaning over than 40. I no longer have the memory I once had, Gary, and I just can't seem to focus on things. This is something that will help everyone. This is brand new information and very important information. It comes from the Quarterly Journal of Experimental Psychology, and it was reported in Science Daily, and it says that we need to detoxify our mind. Now, this is the first time I've ever heard anything like a detox or spring cleaning from orthodox science. They've never used that term. That's like really acknowledging that those in the alternative movement have been onto it on the right path for a long time. Quote, study shows a cluttered brain doesn't remember. I'll quote this verbatim from Science Daily. Lapses in memory occur more frequently with age, yet the reasons for this increasing forgetfulness have not always been clear. According to new research out of Concordia University, older individuals have reduced learning and memory because their minds tend to be cluttered with irrelevant information when performing tasks. Quote, the first step of our study was to test the working memory of a younger and older population, compared the results, and what they found was that there's so much clutter. Now, why is this important? Because here's what they say. They're saying this. I'm not saying it. Quote, older people don't purge irrelevant information. In our health support groups, and more than 30,000 people in this audience have attended the support groups, the very first thing we suggest is that a person does two things simultaneously. Detoxify their lives, in effect, unclutter them. Unclutter them of everything that they no longer want or need. And then the second step is to gradually, at your own pace, and each person is different. Some can do it all at once. Some have to really portion it out so that they don't feel overwhelmed. And bring new things that you need into your life. For example, if you've not spent time studying, bring it in. Put it in your day. Study time. Study a new language, for example. And by the way, on this network, we have Barry Farber. In my personal opinion, one of the most humane, brilliant minds in the history of broadcasting. He speaks, reads, and writes over 32 languages. I don't know any other person who does that. But he's a phenomenal teacher. And when I asked Barry once, how in the world can you learn Japanese fluently and Chinese, two forms of Chinese, and Russian, and all these other languages? They're not the easiest language. And he said, because I don't allow clutter in my mind. When I spoke with the great Dr. Emmanuel Rivisi, who lived to be 102 and was working right up to the day he died, he said, I don't allow clutter in my mind. And then I started thinking about the great artist Paul Swan, something similar, the great feminist writer Helen Severon from the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, who later became an agent and an editor under the name of Sarah Dona, and I worked for her as a ghostwriter when I came to New York City. The great intellects that used to meet in her apartment at night, Thelma Wilson and Herbert Nuremberg and all these great minds. But no one today would remember them because they were old then. I was a 20-year-old, and they were in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, but they were really great thinkers, great social revolutionaries. In any case, they focused on something and they kept that focus like a laser. So when we ask people, unclutter your homes, your offices, your drawers, your closets, your garage, your attic, unclutter, you can do one of three things. Throw it away, give it away, and if you do, give it to someone that you can actually see that person and give it to them, or use it. And then if you think you need a lot, then go back after you've done all this and say, now, how much of this that I have left do I really need? Then look at people the same way. Which people in your life do you really want or need in your life at this time? Some will be the ones that have always been there. Others, that time has come and gone. Those passages are now no longer viable. The energy is no longer connected or vibrating. And then the foods, the beverages, the environment where you live. In other words, we're asking people, get ready for the next passage in your life. Learn the lessons, the ones you've been in, so that the next step in your life will be even better. So by focusing upon one thing at a time, it's like in the park. In fact, last Sunday, this past Sunday in Central Park, we had an enormous crowd there, the largest crowd I've seen in 15 years. In fact, at one point when we had everyone out, the runners went ahead. We had three groups of people, those who are going to run the New York City Marathon, those who are going to jog the New York City Marathon, those who are going to power walk the New York City Marathon. So the joggers and runners had already gone out. There was a bunch of them. And we have coaches who've done at least five marathons who help people. And I was with the walking ones, and then the new ones, Dolores Perry was, and her husband. So at one point, with just my group, and they were over a half mile stretched out in the park. That's how many there were. So this week is our final week for those who would like to do the New York City Marathon with us. It's free. There's no dues or anything. 9 o'clock at 5th Avenue and 90th Street in Central Park. That's this Sunday, the last time you can actually start with us, because we have to have coaches start with the new people who are coming this Sunday. And we have right now about 20 coaches. But with all the enormous amount of people who have joined us this year, we want to make sure everyone gets up and gets into shape and can make it in a healthy way. So it doesn't matter what shape you're in, we'll get you into shape. It'll be a wonderful experience. You'll change your life. And the first thing I say is, don't talk. Just look ahead of you. Think about your breathing. Think about your arms. Think about the hip rotation, how you're placing your foot. Keep your mind. And you can see when people have lost their focus. Unclutter your thoughts so this is what you're focusing on. You're here. You can talk with people later. You can think anything you want later. But right now, your focus is what's important. Now, I ask people to do the same thing. Sit each day and to do some journaling about what's important in your life, your desires, your fantasies, what you would like to do. Not what you can do, but what you would like to do with your life. If you could write a story about where you would like to be, what you would like to be doing, what would it be? And don't say no. Remember, in my world, everything is yes when it comes to human potential. I don't have the word no. So I want people to think the impossible, dream the impossible, so they can at least have a chance of trying the impossible. And everything in life is a learning curve. So it doesn't mean that we're going to succeed at what we're going to try, but at least we're doing it. We're making an honest commitment to it. But that also means we have to unclutter everything else that's inhibiting us, limiting us. And that's what we frequently don't do. We take all the clutter, all the negative thoughts, all of the problems from yesterday, bring it right into today and wonder, gee whiz, why can't I get anything done? Or why can't I feel anything? Well, I'm doing this yoga, I'm not feeling, I'm meditating, I can't focus on it. Because you're bringing clutter in. So now imagine how much clutter you have by the time you're 40, 50, 60. That's now we're understanding from this new study. That's one of the reasons that we're not learning. We're not remembering. Because we have so much trivia, so much useless information. Long ago, I decided I really didn't want to remember names and phone numbers. So I simply don't remember them. I don't put them in my mind. Because I meet so many people, new people every day on the streets and wherever I'm at. You do a book signing, you do a lecture. I just did a lecture. There was 2,000 people, and half of them come over at the end to say hello and get a book signed. I can't remember all those names, and if I did, it would become clutter. So instead, I remember what's important in my life, unless there's someone who's in my life, and of course, you remember their name. But I'm asking the people in this audience now, stop focusing on the trivia, the unimportant. Unclutter it by surrendering the need to keep thinking about it. Just keep saying stop. Stop. Push the stop button on those tapes. Don't allow clutter in. And hence, new thoughts and keep your focus. keep your focus on without, just like a laser beam. I will discipline my mind to think about what, if I'm going to read this book, if I'm going to do this new exercise, if I'm going to power walk, if I'm going to sit and eat a meal, if I'm going to go to the market, I'm going to keep my focus. I'm not going to walk around the aisles with my mind daydreaming. If I'm in a movie, I'm going to focus. If I'm in a play, I'm going to focus. If I'm in a concert, I'm going to focus. I'm not going to allow my mind to be tripping out. We have the power to say stop and refocus. That's just something that's important. And finally, in the area of health and nutrition, I have mentioned many times that what a woman's thinking and what she's eating, what she's breathing and drinking when she's pregnant are crucial to the development of that child. Three separate studies out today, one in development and psychopathology, repeated stress and pregnancy linked to children's behavior. Quote, research from Perth's Telethon Institute for Child Health Research has found a link between the number of stressful events experienced during pregnancy, including thoughts, and increased risk of behavioral problems in their children. Remember I said take at least a year before a choice to become pregnant. So you detoxify the mind, you rebalance your energy, you detoxify the body, so that the only thoughts you're going to focus on are ones that you want to share in a positive way with that developing fetus. Secondly, prenatal pesticide exposure tied to lower IQ in children, University of Berkeley, California, School of Public Health. They found that you can really drop the IQ level in your children if you're exposed to pesticides. And third, prenatal exposure to certain chemicals in the environment impacts cognitive development in children, Mount Sinai School of Medicine. Researchers at Mount Sinai School of Medicine have found that exposure during pregnancy to any number of organophosphates can impair children's cognitive findings. So three separate studies, all in peer-reviewed journals, show that what we think, what we breathe, what we eat, what we're exposed to will directly impact different aspects of a developing child. Hence, really don't get pregnant until you know what you're doing to protect your developing fetus and look at the air, the water, look at your habits, look at your thoughts. All of that will have an impact. I'm Gary Knoll, back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Come and meet those dancing feet. On the avenue I'm taking you to 42nd Street. Hear the beat of dancing feet. It's the song I love, the melody of 42nd Street. Little you see from the cities in Essence and Sweet. Sexy ladies from the 80s, Warren Discreet. They're side by side, they're glorified. Where the other world can't easily.
Welcome all of you. I'm Gary Knoll. Remember, the program on Earth Day tomorrow is this program. Professor Vandana Shiva will be live in studio, but we'll also be interviewing at the same time David Corton, Naomi Klein, and Jeffrey Smith. So you won't want to miss that. Now let's go into our studio in New York City and say hello to Joe. And I believe Jason is also there. Hi, Joe and Jason.
Hey, Gary. How you doing today?
Doing great. Thank you.
We got a question from an unnamed listener, if you have the time.
Sure.
All right. He's been listening to WBAI since he was a teenager in the mid-70s and said he later became a professor of history at a university and still is today. And he found that by the mid-80s, he was having a hard time listening because virtually everything was very slanted. He found everything was pro-Marxist, pro-communist, things about Lenin, Stalin, and Castro, and there was no objective counterpoint or even a pretense of debate. It was very one-sided, and your program was the only one that wasn't. And he stopped listening to the station, but not your show, and appreciates when you talk about history in an honest and objective way. He heard you talking about the Ukraine Holocaust that was put into place by Stalin, and you mentioned the civil war between the Reds and the Whites, but you didn't really go into it. Could you possibly fill in the history for our audience of how the communists came to power and tell us the real history instead of the rewritten history that we've heard 1,000 times from the left?
Okay. First, just a few thoughts. I gave a little background on the Ukraine and the genocide in the Ukraine, the intentional starvation of individuals by Stalin when they went out into the Ukraine that was seeking autonomy, seeking to get their independence, and took all the food they had. They didn't leave them with one morsel of food to eat, nor did they leave with them any seeds that they could plant. And that led to massive starvation. Millions died. But there was something that preceded that. I didn't have a chance to go into the Armenian genocide. But I believe that we should ask the President of the United States in polite and diplomatic emails and our legislators to acknowledge once and for all officially the genocide by Turkey of the Armenians. Now, if our president does not have honest historians around him, just remind him that in 1915 there were about 2.5 million Armenians living in the Ottoman Empire, and that about 1.5 million were murdered. That's genocide. Now, on April 24, 1915, that's the date recognized by Armenians to commemorate the genocide. That was the day that 300 of the leading Armenian intellectuals, and by the way, it's the same Joe in every purge, whether it was Castro, you forgot to mention him, or Mao Zedong, darling of the left. I can't tell you how many arguments I had with those on the left who said, oh, Mao's a murderer. Mao caused 40 million of his own people to starve to death, and then he killed, imprisoned millions of others, and always the intellects. The same was true in Germany. The first thing you do, you go after your dynamic minds. You go after your dynamic supportive, dynamic aggressive, and dynamic assertive minds, because those are the natural leaders, and those are the ones who understand the issue. Well, in Armenia, based upon the size of its population, in the immediate area, they had about 300. Now, these were the writers, the professors, the intellect, the jurists, the lawyers. These were people who were looked upon by the Armenian people as the foundation of their legal and moral rights. So they were all arrested, and they were rounded up in then Constantinople, Istanbul, and deported. They were all killed. But to show that they were not just biased against the intellectual Armenians, they also rounded up at the same time 5,000 of the poorest Armenians. They were all butchered in that one single day. Now, there's a phrase. It's called crimes of lese, L-E-S-E, meaning crimes against humanity. And it was first used on May 2, 1915 by the governments of the UK, France, and Russia, but not the United States. And it was all referring to Armenian genocide. Now, the Armenian genocide was masterminded by the Central Committee for the Young Turk Party. By the way, that was also known as the Committee of Union and Progress. Isn't it interesting how they use those terms, union and progress? And it's really about genocide. It was a racist political organization, and it was connected with the ruling Ottoman Party and based on an ideology created by Ziya Gökalp and Mayeb Nazım and Dr. Bendin Şeker. Now, the acting arm of the Young Turks was called the Special Organization. Where have we heard special operations and special hygiene unit? The Nazis. Theirs was called Special Organization, and it comprised of the most violent minds. Many of them were criminals released from prison. But there were Turks who were supportive of the Armenians and tried to hide them, went to their defense. They were killed also. And most Armenians were rounded from their homes under a systematic program of relocation, but instead of relocating them, they were marched to concentration camps, but this time in a rather really unusual way. They were put into the desert, and they were literally starved to death. No food. Then their homes were taken, their businesses were taken, their bank accounts were confiscated. And if you had jewelry, if you had cash, the word was you would get relocated and you would be able to be okay. That was all a ploy. All the gold and cash, all the jewels were taken by the Turks, and then they were killed anyhow. Even the Germans, as early as 1916, reported, because they were an ally of the Ottoman Empire during World War I, and they reported, who was it? It was Count von Wolf Metternich, who was the ambassador to Turkey, said that this genocide was going on. And so what you had is you had all these people who were rounded up, taken out of their homes, businesses, and killed. Universities, one day a person's teaching, next day they're gone, and they're dead. Even the American consul reported that there was annihilation, extermination, starvation. The Turkish government was ruled by Damad Ferit Pasha. And they, when ruled, I should say, not at that time, they actually recognized the Armenian genocide. And the Turkish court at that time found the leaders of the Young Turks guilty of murder. The Russian Duma in 1994 recognized the Armenian genocide. The Israeli Knesset in 1994 officially condemned it and recognized Armenian genocide. Where in the hell is America? October, I'm not sure the date, 2007, the U.S. House of Representatives Foreign Affairs Committee was expected to approve a bill that called on the USA to recognize the Armenian genocide. However, President Bush promptly lobbied the legislators not to pass a resolution declaring a killing of Armenians by Ottoman Turks to be genocide. Why? The major staging area for Iraq from America was in Turkey. It was an important military base to get supplies and people into Iraq. So in order for us to have political and military accommodation to our need, we denied genocide. And the man personally responsible for denying genocide was President Bush. That's why I believe the man should be held in trials against humanity. I have 100 things that he should be tried for, but that is clearly one of them. But don't ask the Republicans to ever, go against the idea that genocide happens unless it's something they can take advantage of for political capital. But the Democrats were also equally responsible, because Bill Clinton also had an opportunity and chose not to engage it. And then on March 4th last year, the House Committee on Foreign Affairs approved a resolution condemning the World War I slaughter of Armenians as genocide. In fact, Prime Minister, who was it, Erdogan, called for the expulsion of Americans from Turkey and recalled Turkey's ambassador from the U.S. for consultations. And so what did Obama do? Obama chose not to use the term Armenian genocide to refer to the killings. My God, I don't even want to talk anymore about Obama and his being the coward along with Bush and the rest of them. Anyhow, that's what I want to say on that. Now, more importantly, you have to understand how did the communists come to power? There was a man in power at that time. He was Nicholas II. He was the total ruler of all Russia. He was the wealthiest man in the world. There was no one that had the wealth. He owned the gold mines. He owned the Trans-Siberian Railroad. He owned the forest. He had all these. He had the largest palace in the world, the Winter Palace, with over 320 rooms. He had wealth beyond imagination. But he also was married to Alexandra, who was from the Habsburg Empire, and as a result, German connections. Now, here's a problem. You have Russia and Germany in the First World War. Russia was told by many of his advisors of the Tsar, don't go to war. We don't need this war. Germany's not going to invade us. We don't need that problem. But he was an extraordinarily immature person. He was very young when he became the Tsar. His father, Nicholas II, had died after he was in a train crash, but he was a gigantic man, and he held the part of the roof up so other people could escape. But he succumbed. And his mother, Maria, became a dowager very young. Then there were two courts. There was the old court that was part of the 300-year unbroken rule of the Romanovs over Russia. And there was the young court. And the young court was despised by everyone because they didn't believe in formalities of the old court. And Alexandria was very frugal. She even had Olga, Tatiana, Maria, and Anastasia, her four daughters, sew their own clothes. She didn't believe in the big parties. So you had the old aristocracy and then this new frugal aristocracy, and then you had this very immature fellow who became the head of the war effort. While this was going on, there were shortages of food. And most people may not be aware of it, but the whole reason that Lenin, who was in exile at that time, was able to return from exile from Switzerland, and Stalin wasn't a figure of any importance at that point. He came after Lenin, and Trotsky was actually equal in importance to Lenin. He was number two after Lenin, and became head of the whole war operation. He became head of all armed forces. It was the women. It was February 23rd, 1917, when the first major bread strike occurred. The women began to leave factories and protest and go to the streets. At that time, the capital of Russia was not St. Petersburg, but rather Petrograd, that would later become St. Petersburg. And the women, a few hundred, then 1,000, then 2,000, and 10,000. Next thing you knew, you had 10,000, 15,000 women who were protesting because all they wanted was bread. That was the initial march. Then someone got the bright idea, let's go over to the men's factories and get the men to come out and join us and support us in the bread revolution, the bread strike. And so this began the first big protest. And so then the men came out, and then the police came and to stop them. And then by the end of the day, the signs had gone from "we want bread" to "we want the czar gone." And this went on for several days. And then the czar got word at the front that there was trouble at home, and he didn't consider it important. People wanting bread, so what? Now, mind you, here's how simple it would have been. All the czar had to do is simply make extra loaves of bread and give extra rations that he had. These were all in warehouses, the food he could have given it to the poor and the needy. He chose not to. And because of that, and every day the strikes intensified. Now, does that sound familiar to anything we're seeing in the Middle East today? People went to the streets not because they were against America or against necessarily the ruler. It wasn't because they were promoting their religion, but because they were wanting food. And then after that, then they wanted food and jobs. Then after that, then they wanted food, jobs, and freedom. And then the freedom to meet, freedom of expression, freedom of the press, freedom to create a new government. It builds on itself, and it will not be turned back. The only thing that the people in power can do is fight back. And how do they fight? Almost always by using force. And how did they learn that? Through America. Where did they get their arms and special training in how to stop any form of sedition? By the CIA and our intelligence agencies. So, when you have photographs and backgrounds on some of the leaders, fine, you get them arrested. But what happens when there's 300 to take the place for every three that you arrest? And then there's 3,000, and then there's 30,000. And that's what happens when those poor that we knew were poor and hungry, that we knew were hungry and unemployed, and we knew they were unemployed because we, the United States, we, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, Ronald Reagan, Bush Sr., and Bush Jr., and all have participated in the suppression of human rights, the suppression of all rights in every country in the Middle East. We are the 8,000-pound gorilla on the block. They, the gold-plated, oil-soaked sheikhs and despotic rulers, they are merely the front people for who's on the back end controlling this. So the czar then sent out the people who were considered the most feared of all warriors, the Cossacks. And the Cossacks were the personal guards of the Tsar. And all the Cossacks moved into the streets, and they confronted the people. And at one point, they were ready to fire upon the people, and there was a gesture of peace given by one of the protesters. And the head Cossack chose not to fire on the people. As a result, the people said, "Then be with us." And that's when that's when it started. And then they created the slogan, "Freedom or Death." Now it ratchets up. And then there was, by the fifth day, there was direct orders of the Tsar, shoot the demonstrators. And so some police shot, and there were about 50 who died. And then they got more soldiers to join the people. And there was a little island very close, within hours of Petrograd and Kronstadt. And there were 30,000 of the best trained sailors in all of Russia. Now, mind you, they hadn't participated in the First World War, so they were healthy, they were well-fed, extremely disciplined, and they were told, move on the demonstrators. And so they sailed, but instead of joining to fight the people, they joined the people. And the first thing they did, they shot all the commanders, including the admiral who ran the whole base. And that was the end of Russia. Now, at that point, then, and only then, when suddenly there was freedom in Russia, then there was a new provincial government, and then the Soviets came forward as one movement. And the government, however, even though they were told the Tsar tried to get back to Petrograd on his train, and his train was stopped. And he was told, come back and you'll be shot. Abdicate. And after, I think it was 2 days or 3 days, he finally abdicated. So now you had no Tsar. The 300-year rule of the Romanovs was over. You had the highest respected, most feared groups, the Cossacks and the Navy, working with the people, and you had a provincial government. But the provincial government wanted to keep the war up. Now, yes, they were all considered pro-people, but they were all the landowners. They were all the wealthiest. And then in comes, in a secret, from Switzerland, Vladimir Ilanovich, better known as Lenin. And he was talking about having a complete socialist future. And then he put out these principles, and it was called the 10 April Thesis, which meant that all power to make all decisions had to go to a central body, the Soviets. But his party was the Bolsheviks. And he created a new slogan. And this slogan was in everyone's mind in Russia. Peace, bread, land. So if you join the movement, you would get bread, you'd have your land, and you would be at peace. So then the provincial government tried to move in and they wanted to go against Germany. And Lenin says, no, bring our troops back, make an offensive. And that's where it all happened. And then you had the soldiers in July 4th, 1917. The soldiers went against, the sailors went against Lenin and against Petrograd. And when they were all together and Lenin was right there and could have taken over the provincial government, he chose not to. He was ill-prepared. Lenin mistrusted mass spontaneous operations. He wanted everything methodically planned out. So they went ahead and all these protesters went over to take over the provincial government and surround it, and all these sharpshooters were up on the roof. Gee whiz, where did we hear this again? Sharpshooters on the roof protecting the provincial government, the ruling government, and killing all the people, and there was mass pandemonium, and everyone fled. And so that didn't work. And then you had Alexander Kerensky was appointed the head and of the new provincial government. And all the while, Lenin he had actually gone into hiding in Finland. He came back, and Kerensky thought, okay, we'll go against Lenin. We'll arm the people. Big mistake. When he armed the people turned against him. And so anyhow, this is how it happened. Once Lenin solidified his power, then he started to go against anyone who was against him. He didn't believe in sharing power. He had a constituents assembly that was supposed to represent full democracy, but the Bolsheviks overtook it. And Lenin set up what is called the Checker. The Checker was a preceder of the KGB, the all-powerful police. They believed that any opposition party, any opposition group should be arrested and killed. If you criticize Lenin, if you criticize the Bolsheviks, if you criticized anything, you were to be killed. And they had all these people that had actually helped in the initial revolution. They were all arrested. And then there was a group that had been working with the army, the Czechs, who in the east of Russia then started to march. There were about, I think, 20,000 of them. They started to march against Lenin, and that's what started the next part of the Civil War, which lasted for 3 years, and the Bolsheviks solidified their power. Now, Lenin, I think it was August 1918, was shot twice, almost died, but because he didn't die, he was then called the Chosen One, and then he created what was called the Red Terror. All intellectuals were to be arrested and killed, and because he felt threatened by him. And he killed over 6,000 intellectuals in just a very short period of time. And then they killed the Tsar on their way east and his family. And there are about 40,000 people now engaged as rebels. The rebels were moving on to the Bolsheviks, and then America and the other countries got involved. And they didn't get involved because they wanted to see justice. They got involved because they were fearful that if Lenin and his Bolsheviks, and hence communists, that's communists evolve after the Reds and after the Bolsheviks and after the Soviets. So it went the Soviets, which was the public, then that evolved into Bolsheviks, then it evolved into the communists. They were terrified that their companies, their financial holdings around the world could be threatened by this movement. And that's why they sent troops. There were about 200,000 troops from France, U.S., Germany, and Japan that went. And then they had this famous Battle of Kazan, and which the invading forces lost. And there was another 2 years to this. At the end of all this, 3 million soldiers were killed. 2 million civilians were killed. 5 million people starved to death. Why? Because what Lenin did was he said, we've got to feed our troops and the ruling leaders, and he confiscated all the food, even the planting seed, from the peasants. So the people who were supposed to be liberated were actually starved to death. How many? 5 million. So preceding, this is, you know, now we're talking about like 1921. That's when this whole purge, this solidification of power occurred. And by 1920, commissars replaced any democratic elected officials, and hence the total one-party centralized power evolved. And then those original people, the soldiers, the sailors who came from the island to help win the revolution, without which there would not have been a Russia revolution, there would have been no overthrow of the Tsar, we would not have had communism, every one of those people were attacked, and they were killed. In one of the greatest atrocities, the Third Revolution, Trotsky led the attack, and 12 to 15,000 prisoners were taken into the woods and shot. And they had to dig their own graves, and it was bitterly cold, so the prisoners were waiting to be shot, made fire so they could stay warm until they were actually shot. And that's a little-known part of the grab for power, and after that, there was no one competing for power against Lenin, the communists, and the Red Army. And that began 76 years, a complete rule. And so when I hear people try to make light of this, deny it, rewrite history, as they did with Mao, as they did with Stalin, as they did with so many others, I ask, why can't you study history that's real and not just politically aligned? Hope that answers that question. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Gary.
Let's go over now. My guest is on, and say hello to Dr. Lynn. We're going to say hello, Dr. Lynn Saputo. Dr. Saputo is a board-certified physician in internal medicine and the founder and medical director of Health Medicine Foundation in California. And he's been practicing since about 1965. He graduated from Duke University. And he is also a renowned expert in phononic stimulation therapy for a wide range of diseases and detoxification. And he's also the author of A Return to Healing. So let's see if we have him on the line. And if we do, we can say hello to him. Dr. Lynn Saputo, nice to have you with us again today.
Gary, it's always a pleasure to be on your show. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. I want to ask you two questions, and then please take them as definitively as you choose.
Okay, thank you.
I'm concerned that we do not have democracy in medicine. In fact, we have something that should be challenged as voraciously as any other freedom that has been denied or usurped by specific special interest groups. But that hasn't happened yet. And I believe that when you as a physician, or any physician, and we have almost a million physicians, that when these individuals continue to use therapies that are proven not only not to work, but to do harm, and the number one cause of death is iatrogenesis, or medically induced death, the number one cause of injury is iatrogenesis, and we have proven that using their own figures. These are not made up out of whole cloth. These are from their journals. And no one cares. They're not changing anything. And I just did the math. And the math is, over the last 20 years, just with cancer, more than 5 million Americans have died only using their therapy. No other therapy. I'm not talking about any alternative therapy. And yet you would think that if 5 million people died from anything, someone would say, let us examine this. Yet they're not examining it. And they're not acknowledging that they're responsible on any level for any of this, and yet they continue to have all the respect to the mainstream media, so that the moment you challenge them, you're looked upon as the quack, the charlatan. Who are you? How dare you challenge these people? So the mainstream media protects them. The institutions in our government, like National Institutes of Health, solidify their power, and they're getting away with murder. I want to ask you, as a board-certified physician, why has this happened? It's not a question, is has it happened? The evidence is overwhelming and irrefutable. Why does this continue to go on, and why aren't they looking at what can really help people that are proven to be natural, non-toxic? The form is yours.
That's a great question, Gary, and I totally agree with you. It's not just in medicine. It's business, it's law, it's religion, it's science, it's sport. We're locked into a social paradigm that's based on narcissism and on what we get for what we do. Medicine has become a J-O-B. It's become a job. And we work for a salary. And unfortunately, we get a lot of really good people going to medical school who have their hearts in the right place, who want to do good, they want to help humanity, and they get into a system that's filled with conflicts of interest. In fact, as you said, it's corrupt, and unfortunately, we are committing murder. We so much as a medical profession, meaning the doctors, are not the ones that are guilty, in my opinion. I think we've gone along with what's happened that's been imposed by the pharmaceutical industry, the insurance industry, the technology industry, that's interested in making money. You follow the dollars, you'll find out why people are doing what they're doing. And that infection has spread to the medical doctors as well. When you go through your training, which might be 10, 15 years, and you're brainwashed every day that these are the answers that you must use for the healthcare issues that you are faced with, you begin to believe this stuff that's bunk. You begin to think that drugs are the solution, that technology are the solution to problems. You begin to believe that the medical research that's been done is infallible and we should definitely believe it. And we find out that this is not the case. We can't believe our medical research because it's published by who? It's like the fox guarding the chicken coop. We publish stuff mostly from Big Pharma, which spends about $92 billion a year on medical research, which is a massive amount more than what the National Institutes of Health spends, which is closer to $30 billion a year. And there's a relationship between the two that's corrupt as well. It doesn't mean there aren't good scientists out there and good people who would like to do the right thing, because there definitely are. But when you are getting money from your research from a company that has a conflict of interest because they've got a product that they want to make look good, and they say, thank you very much, Mr. Scientist, for doing this research. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to interpret it for you. And even though it looks like it didn't turn out so good, we'll find a way to turn it around. And they do. And that's what happens. In fact, a lot of these articles are written as ghost writers, meaning they bring people in to make it look the way they want to, because it's a business. So we see things that are tragic. We see the Vioxx scandal, which you've, I'm sure, talked about many times on your show, where a pharmaceutical company comes in. They know they've got a product that's going to kill thousands and thousands of people. They don't tell the FDA about it. At least we don't think they did. And they come out with it anyway. And then 40, 50,000 people have heart attacks and strokes from it that wouldn't have otherwise. And then they say, oh, we didn't know that. And they'll agree to take the drug off the market $20 billion later, and are happy to pay the $5 billion in lawsuits because it's a good business investment. And as you use the words murder, I do too, because it's exactly what it is. And it's stunning that we don't have a system that will prosecute these people who have made these decisions, because it's outright murder. So you've got a great point there.
Okay, well then, in point of fact, Dr. Graham from the FDA,
yes,
repeatedly warned the FDA higher-ups at the time, mm-hmm, that David Graham, that, yes, there were, that this would cause increases in heart attack and stroke, 120,000 heart attacks and strokes, 60,000 dead. They paid $5.85 billion, and not a single prosecution occurred.
It's stunning. I mean, you have to wonder, what the hell is going on in this country? You talk about the loss of democracy. Absolutely. But it's not just in medicine. Unfortunately, it's across the whole board. And what we need is to raise our level of consciousness first and recognize what we're doing, and then take some kind of personal action. And the problem is we don't think that one person can make a difference. And my position is that only one person can make a difference. It has to start that way. It starts with a single thought. And then you must be the change you want to see. And if you will behave that way, others will notice it. And they will be inspired by what they see, if it's a good thing. And if that happens, it becomes a contagious thing. And you get to a tipping point where suddenly you've moved from a narcissistic, self-serving, financially based model into something that is a higher level of consciousness, where you're wanting to give and share and support and do the right thing and help people to listen and to care, rather than just throw drugs and surgeries and technologies at them. Now, the danger of this kind of language I'm using is that people say, well, gee, don't you think there's some good things about medicine? The answer is, of course there's some good things about medicine. You'd have to be an idiot to throw medicine out. But you'd be a worse idiot to use it as a first and primary tool, because it's too invasive, it's too lethal. As your wonderful video, Death by Medicine, explains, and their paper that you wrote with three other people, several of which were MDs, you point out from our own mainstream work how prevalent and dangerous the things are that we do. Medicine's too complicated. Unless we evolve to that place where we want to be supporting and giving and sharing and doing what we can for our neighbors, we will be at a level of consciousness that is too narcissistic. And what we're getting is what we're sowing. We're reaping what we sow. So it's good to point these things out. And that's a starting point that's indispensable. But it's just as critical that we do more than just become outraged. Outrage doesn't solve anything. It's just a way of complaining and say, this is a terrible situation. Somebody's got to fix it. Not realizing that the only somebody that can fix it is yourself.
Well, let's do this. I just wanted to get you on to talk about the overview. I have a lot of specifics, especially in the war on AIDS, that I consider complete fiasco, and I know you've studied this.
Yes.
I'd like to invite you back for a full hour, just you and I for 1 hour next week. Can you do that?
Yep.
Then we will go into the following. Next week we will explore what in medicine is dangerous and unproven, and we should be very concerned about if we're told to do something. What in medicine works and can help us in the healing process. And where can we do something as far as the politics of medicine? What can we actually do in a real sense to make a difference? So those are my questions that we will use as the basis for our in-depth one-hour discussion next week. All right?
That will be exciting, Gary. I look forward to that because that's a wonderful program.
And thank you very much for, I understood that you were up at the Sonoma Film Festival north of in Napa Valley and set in on and did a discussion on Death by Medicine at the film festival there.
I've got to congratulate you, Gary. You did a wonderful piece of work here. You've done the groundwork that exposes people to what's really happening in healthcare. It shows the viciousness and the self-centeredness and narcissism of the business and the corporate democracy that we now live in. And we must, everybody should see that film. That should be a requirement because it gives you a true picture of what's happening and it leads you to want to do something personally about it. Congratulations to you. It's a landmark film.
Thank you very much. Dr. Lynn Saputo, my guest. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Dr. Saputo will be back for a full 60 minutes interview next week where we'll go into great depth on all these. Please listen in tomorrow where we'll have Naomi Klein and we'll have Mr. Smith and all the other greats on Earth Day. Have a nice day, everyone.
Come on along and listen to Lullaby of Broadway, the hip hooray and ballyhoo, a lullaby of Broadway, the rumble of the subway train, the rattle of the taxis, the daffodils who entertain at when a Broadway baby says goodnight, it's early in the morning. Manhattan babies don't sleep tight until the dawn. Good night, baby. Good night. Milkman's on his way.
The Gary Nall Show is produced in our New York City studio. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kempf. The chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Jason Taubenfeld.